From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The catchphrase from the television series The X-Files probably best sums up why legends persist. I want to believe. And we do. Some of us, anyway, want to believe. There's a Byzantine series of tunnels under Salt Lake City, that there's an immense snake-like monster in the turquoise waters of the Bear Lake, that three ancient and immortal Nephites wander the world, that if you walk around a tomb in the Salt Lake City cemetery, you'll see the face of the person buried there. But why do we want to believe? That's the question at the heart of the show today. Mostly it's about telling stories, something whimsical to help you make the transition away from the election season. Our guests today have heard them all, these legends, or most of them anyway. So we're hoping you'll join us with your own stories that you're pretty much sure are true. Utah Legends, after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Every family has one, every community, every place, a myth, a legend, with lost mines and three Nephites and grieving Indian maidens and a lake monster. Utah is full of them. Whether they can be proven true or not doesn't really matter in some ways. They're great stories, and they teach us a lot about who we are. Joining us today is the folklorist David Stanley, who recently retired from Westminster College, where he was a professor of English. He is the editor of the book Folklore in Utah, and also a book called Cowboy Poets and Cowboy Poetry. David Stanley specializes in folklore and literature of the American West. And David Stanley, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for inviting me.
Should say welcome back.
Thank you.
Historian Will Bagley is also with us, who is the Wallace Stegner Centennial Fellow at the Tanner Humanities Center. Will writes about early pioneer history of Utah and the West, the editor of the series Kingdom in the West, The Mormons and the American Frontier. The latest volume was just published, and it's called Innocent Blood. And Will Bagley, welcome back to you.
Always entertaining.
Let me, I want to ask first of all, why is it, David Stanley, that we want to believe? Why is it that we, what is that, because we do, we want these stories to be true, or we want something about them to be true. Is that right?
Well, a lot of times they are true.
Yeah.
And I think that the reason that we're so invested in the legends of a particular place is that it animates that place. It gives life to it, gives personality to it. So whether you're talking about Emo's grave in the Salt Lake City Cemetery, or the legend of Dead Horse Point down in Canyonlands, or even how a particular place like the little town of Levan in central Utah got its name, it provides interest and entertainment, of course, but it also provides meaning and connection that we need to feel at home, especially when we live in a culture as mobile as ours is, where people move, what is it, every 7 years? Hmm. It gives us a sense of connection that we might not have otherwise.
Well, Bagley, how do you think about these legends that you hear and the origins, where they come from? What is it about human nature that that creates them or perpetuates them or embellishes them?
Well, I think that human beings are by nature storytellers. Storytelling is how we pass on our culture, how we pass on our values. Dave and I were discussing how fundamental storytelling is to so many different disciplines, novelists, playwrights, songwriters, historians, and of course, folklorists. Mm. We all are engaged in the business of telling some aspect of the human story.
Is Utah, David Stanley, unique in any way in the kinds of stories, the motifs of stories are here, or are they all fairly universal in some ways?
No, there are some that are specific to Utah, and I think that would be true of any state in the country or any locality. But, of course, what gives Utah its special flavor is the incredible journey of the Mormon pioneers across the plains and their arrival here in 1847. So many family narratives and so many state narratives, as well as religious ones, emanate from that trek, and with the subsequent interactions with Native Americans, the gold prospectors and the other Gentiles that came through Salt Lake in the 19th century, it goes on and on from there. And a lot of the folklore in the state has to do not only with things that Mormons tell about Mormon culture, but that Mormons tell about Gentiles and Gentiles tell about Mormons, and the entire sense of what it means to be part of an in-group and what the out-group is like. That's a big part of folklore in Utah.
So folklore, in some ways, it helps us try to get a bearing on what that group is like or how we fit into the scheme of things.
Absolutely. And I think folklore has very positive associations for most people. It's how we connect with our ancestors. It's how we connect with our culture. It's how we connect with our communities. But let's face it, a lot of antagonism is expressed through folklore as well. And we shouldn't be blinded to the fact that folklore, by which we mean the way human beings interact with each other in small groups, basically, the things that we say in a traditional kind of way rather than something that has to do with what kind of coffee you want to order at the local coffee bar or Postum, perhaps. But that's a big part of Utah folklore, both the positive and the negative. And we have to recognize both sides.
I think Utah shares more of the great themes of folklore with folklore in general than I would call it unique. But it does have some very specific features. And one of the experiences that I think is profoundly reflected in Utah's folklore is this encounter with the Great Basin environment, how deeply people are moved by this different world. The first people who came in from the East were mostly New Englanders or raised in the American Middle West, and they'd come from a very green world. And it's hard for us to appreciate today how alien the American West looked to these people, how stark this arid environment, and how unwelcoming. But within a generation, you have people who are born here and who it is their home country. And you see this confrontation in a lot of ways. People are trying to tame this environment, and it's untamable. But you see these themes of man against nature or man working with nature again and again in Utah's stories.
So I want to jump right in here. There's a legend of the three Nephites. David Stanley, start, if you would, by telling us about the Reverend David Utter. He was a Unitarian minister from Chicago, came to this area, was the first Unitarian minister of this region, I guess.
That's right.
And became quite fascinated with the legend of the three Nephites.
This was a time, 1891, when there was a developing awareness of regional cultures, of locality, of what makes Utahns, not Utahns, but Americans different according to where they happen to live. And this was the Reverend Utter's participation in this was to observe the civilization that he had been suddenly dropped down into as if it was a foreign land, a foreign culture. And he found Mormonism fascinating, and he found especially legends about the three Nephites fascinating. And he reported these legends to a little journal called The Folklorist in Chicago in 1892-93. A year or two later, the Unitarian Church ran out of money and had to fire him. And he nevertheless stayed on and got a job teaching social studies at the local high school. I'm not sure how long he stayed in Utah, but certainly he found it a fascinating place to live, as so many outsiders have found it to be.
The three Nephites, this comes from, Will Bagley, it comes from a story from the Book of Mormon. Does it not?
It parallels in some ways some of the prophecies associated with the Apostle John in the New Testament. And in the Book of Mormon, Jesus tells three of his apostles that they will stay until he returns. And so this generates the story that there are these immortal spiritual men who have not tasted death and very typically do not appear in business suits or as prosperous stalwarts. They appear as very humble working people. And they cure diseases, they perform miracles. And then the constant theme of this is that whoever the benefactor has been, you turn your back on them and suddenly they're gone. Or they take a team and a horse down the road and the neighbor comes up and Wallace Stegner tells this story. The beneficiary says, well, did you run into that homespun-looking guy going down the road with the broken-down team? And the neighbor says, what team? This factor of miracle, of disappearance and appearance, and always at an opportune time. It's astonishing, too, how the story persists and how many families have their story of their encounter with one of the three Nephites. Hmm. Sometimes they appear in threes, but generally it's a single person.
What are the stories you hear about the three Nephites?
Well, I've read a lot of them, and the great folklorist Bert Wilson at BYU has compiled, I think it's about 1,500 of them. He's working on a book on the
1,500
three
Nephites. 1,500 of them?
1,500.
Wow.
And but as Will said, there are discernible patterns here. And one of them is that they're always anonymous. They never identify themselves by name, nor do they say that they are a Nephite. They come and they go. When they leave, there are no footprints in the snow or the sand or the dust of the road. And the other interesting thing about these Nephite legends, and of course they have been reported since around 1855, I believe, when one of the apostles of the church made a statement about the appearance of a Nephi in one of his sermons.
They just started popping up once someone started talking about it.
Yes, and as Will said, there is a basis for that in the Book of Nephi,
sure,
and in the Book of Mormon. So, but what's interesting is the way the legends have changed over the years, because in the 1930s and 40s, the very popular Nephite legend, which is still around today, was combined with the urban legend that we call the Vanishing Hitchhiker.
Yeah, yeah.
And so let's say a Mormon family has broken down on a remote road and a man appears and repairs the engine or provides some kind of service that enables the car to start going again. And as they go down the road, they realize that the man has left something behind, and they try to track him down and discover, of course, that he had died some years before. So what we see here is the adoption of the legend of the three Nephites into the automotive age. And nowadays, we're starting to hear about three Nephites who make phone calls and so forth. I'm waiting for the first three Nephite cell phone story in which your phone rings when you're in a time of desperate trouble.
Yeah.
And a mysterious voice gives you advice. I'm making this up, of course. I haven't actually heard such a story, but I hope somebody will tell me one. But I think that these stories are wonderful because they suggest that there is difficulty in this world and there is crisis in people's lives, but that there is a higher power that can be helpful here. And whether it manifests itself as one of the Nephites or whether it's expressed through prayer, it nevertheless provides a sense of relief and a sense of succor and a sense that there may be a better time ahead.
I've got my own three Nephite story.
Really?
Yeah.
From the Bagley family or?
My personal experience. I was driving on the back roads to Panguitch once and my car broke down. And these three guys pull over in a pickup truck and come over and open the hood and close it and the car's all fixed. But then they say to me, where are you going? And I said, I'm going to Panguitch. They said, well, what are you going to do? I said, well, I'm going there to tell them the truth about the Mountain Meadows Massacre. And they beat the hell out of me. There's another one.
Did you see Butch Cassidy and Panguitch while you were there?
I saw him in Circleville.
Let's go to the phones. Veronica is with us in Provo. Veronica, hi.
Hi. I went to school in northern Mexico in an area called the Mormon Colonies. And a lot of the women there have come from Utah. They've married into Mexican families, having been brought from areas in Utah and Arizona. And we have our own stories in the colonies of the three Nephites coming and providing succor or comfort in difficult times. I just find it interesting that they've, you know, we have our own stories there also.
Mm-hmm. Yes, please.
Yeah, these are called migratory legends because they have a kind of a particular core of plot pattern and character and so forth, like a kind of a skeletal short story. And then what frequently happens is that the belief system is there, and then the particular individual circumstances of the village, the country, the culture, the colony, whatever it may be, is added onto it. And this is very common throughout the world. Legends migrate from one place to another and receive this local coloration that's very important.
Veronica, glad you called. Thanks very much. David Stanley is the author of the book Folklore in Utah. Will Bagley is also with us, an historian of Utah and the West. His latest from the series Kingdom in the West, The Mormons and the American Frontier, is called Innocent Blood. We're going to take a brief break. Back in a moment. This is Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio.
Sentinel spires of cactus stand, timeless guards of a rugged land, where the wind-blown sand has but one goal, is to rip and tear and gouge the soul in you, dog. I was born in poverty, south of Moab quietly. Life was hard, but I learned to stand, punching cows as I ran a hand in Utah.
Wanderlust calls me to roam, quit the saddle, left my home, wander west to the Frisco Bay. Hail a ship and a sail away from Utah.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, something sort of whimsical, I think, for to help you make the transition from the election season. We're talking about legends today, Utah legends, and there are lots of them. About lost mines and grieving Indian maidens. There's one called Kay's Cross. There's a series of one about a series of mysterious tunnels under Salt Lake City. There's a weeping tree, a monster in a lake, and we talked earlier about three Nephites who are said to wander the world. Folklorist David Stanley is with us, along with the historian Will Bagley. Let's go to the phones. Rory is with us in Moab. Rory, welcome.
Hi, Doug.
Hi.
Hey, down here we have a pretty interesting story. The facts that we know are that in, I believe it was 1853, the Mormons sent a mission down here, and that in the fall of the year, that mission was attacked by the local Ute Indians, and the settlers fled. But there was never any record, as far as anybody knows, of why they were attacked. And then in the early 1930s, a local by the name of Otho Murphy wrote a little historical pamphlet and repeated the rumor that the reason the Indians attacked the Mormons was because the Indians had offered the Mormons Indian wives, and they had rejected the wives, and the tribe became upset and angry and retaliated. So the Mormons left, and by the time they came back to Spanish Valley in the 1870s, there were other people here, Texas cowboys and Basque shepherds and settlers, and as a consequence, Grand County has always been a minority Mormon county, and we just voted for Obama, one of two counties in Utah that did, and it was because of that. But I think the interesting thing is nobody's ever been able to, as far as I know, clarify whether that, you know, why that rumor came about.
Anyone know?
I'll take this.
Yeah.
This is an example of how folklore can stand history on its head. The Elk Mountain Mission, I think, was sent out in 1854 or 55, just as the report says. But these early Indian missionaries often had very specific instructions. Marry the leading Indian women to secure that alliance with the native peoples. This is documented in our book on Fort Limhi by David Bigler. And this was a tactic that the Mormons used to try to create a firm alliance with their Israelite cousins, the Lamanites. Now, as time goes by, polygamy becomes a big embarrassment. And so in telling this story, this person says that, oh, the Indians offered the wives. Well, in fact, Indians had been dealing with mountain men who would often marry into their tribes, and they were very completely accepted. But when the Mormons come out and start putting pressure on them to give up women, many of the Indian leaders say, well, that will work great, but I want a white wife. And there's some hedging and going back and forth, but it's also some believe that Wakara, the great Ute leader, was poisoned after he became very adamant about getting a white wife. So it's a fascinating example of how you take real events. And the reason the Elk Mountain Mission collapsed was that the Indians didn't like the fact that the Mormons came in, appropriated their resources, and abused them. So that's why they pushed them out. It's also a very telling example of how effective Indian resistance could be.
And I think that this is a good example of a legend that's created after the fact. We need to understand the circumstances of our history so desperately that very often we'll fasten on usually an explanation that satisfies us.
Sure.
Here was this mission that was sent down there to spread the gospel, to help, if possible, the Indians, to spread the empire as far as possible, to safeguard its frontiers at a very difficult political period around the time of the Gadsden Purchase and so forth. And why would the Indians attack this peaceful, loving group of people? Will mentioned that they perhaps foresaw that their resources would be appropriated. Certainly there was plenty of oral communication with other Native American groups in other parts of the West, and most of those were pretty negative.
Yeah.
So I suspect that what happened was that as different reports about different incidents were passed around, eventually the community kind of settled on this explanation that the reason for the attack was this particular action, which, of course, made the Mormons' fidelity to their white wives praiseworthy,
mm-hmm.
in contrast to this this possible speaking of the election, the possibility of creating a mixed race people.
Mm-hmm.
And there's also the firming up a broader cultural myth, the notion that the Mormons and the Indians got along very well. It was only the outsiders who fractured this benevolent, wonderful relationship. But in fact, I'm editing an 1849 journal in which the journalist reports the Utes coming up and saying how unhappy they are with the Mormons very, very early on.
Back to the phones. Rory, thanks very much, by the way. Abby is with us in Ogden. Abby, welcome.
Thank you. I was calling. My grandma has a cabin at Bear Lake, and she always told us that the Bear Lake monster was the sun, because we all got sunburns because it was so high in altitude.
Well, let's talk about the Bear Lake monster. Abby, a good segue, because this is one of the prominent legends in Utah.
Abby, what do you know?
Abby. Sorry, my fault. She just said her mother explained it as the sun. But this legend, David Sinley, has been around this part of the state for a long time. What do you know about the Bear Lake monster?
Well, back in the 19th century, credible people good members of the church reported having seen a mysterious creature in Bear Lake. There have been some reports of a Great Salt Lake monster, but I don't think that they're nearly as common because that salty environment's a little harder for monsters to deal with than freshwater. There is a painting by a local resident in the Fife Folklore Archives at Utah State University, which shows the Bear Lake monster, who looks rather like the kind of fire-breathing dragon that is popular among Chinese people at New Year's. Wow. And he's raising up out of the lake and spouting fire from his mouth at a boat with a couple of frightened people in it. But obviously, whether you're talking about Loch Ness or Bear Lake or Lake Champlain in New York and Vermont, large bodies of water encourage people to imagine that there might be something deep down there.
Except, of course, there really is.
Yeah, Will's a believer, we should say.
Now, one thing few people have ever noted, except me maybe, is that in the 1670s, off of New England, a sea serpent appeared, and it was seen all up and down the Long Island Sound, all the way along much of the New England coast. And the images that we have of it resemble quite closely many of the reports of the appearance of the Bear Lake monster, about which we have a number of confusing reports. But it's also very interesting to note that the reason the Salt Lake monster doesn't have credibility is because it's a salt lake, but also because all the documented reports we have come from people in advanced states of intoxication. But the people who report seeing the Bear Lake monster include many, many members of the First Presidency, very sober, prominent pioneers such as Phineas Cook. And to my mind, the absolute proof that there was a Bear Lake monster is that not only did Brigham Young believe in the Bear Lake monster, he invested in the Bear Lake monster. He put resources into trying to catch the beast.
They had this big barbed hook that they were trying to...
Very scientific approach.
Yeah. I wonder
and
what
the sheep
baited.
Always disappeared.
Yeah.
Well, that's interesting because, of course, the Puritans of New England were encouraged to report what they called remarkable providences. And these were evidences of God's favor or disfavor toward the colony. And it could be an earthquake. In one famous case, it was a mouse chewing on a prayer book, which turned out to be not the Bible, but the Book of Common Prayer of the Anglican Church, and therefore a sign of God's favor. Monsters were frequently reported in New England during this time period, and they were often seen as warnings from God to for the second and third generations of Puritans to shape up and to live the doctrine. It's entirely possible, given the New England origins of the Mormon Church, that a lot of these tales were carried either in printed form or in memory across the plains and then were, again, adapted to the local environment. I can't prove that, though.
No, but I think it's obvious.
Abby, thanks very much. Let's go back to the phones. Ben is with us in Ogden. Ben, hi.
Hi, how are you guys?
Fine, thanks.
Hey, I have a I used to live in St. George, Utah, and there was a legend they used to tell that the Mormon temple, when it was built, Brigham Young wanted a certain type of steeple on the top, and they did not build the one he wanted, and he passed away. And a year to the day that he died, apparently it was struck by lightning, and it burnt down just the steeple. And they took that as a sign that he was not happy, so they rebuilt it the way he wanted to. And I just didn't know if you'd heard of that and what you knew of it.
Will Bagley, any idea?
I have heard the story, and I think there may be a factual basis to it. But the architecture and building of the St. George Temple is really quite an epic story. And part of it is that, as he did in Salt Lake, right after arriving, Brigham Young picked a spot in St. George to have the temple built. And it was done by inspiration. But unfortunately, it just happened that it was a very problematic site because half of it was positioned over a very hard rock base, and the other side wasn't. It was on, I think, maybe even a swampy ground. So they had to deal with both this almost impenetrable subsurface on one side and a less than desirable foundation on the other. And they use a cannon as a pile driver. It really is an extraordinary feat for a place so poor to have produced such a remarkable example of folk architecture. And I've heard the story of the towers, but I'm not sure how that
David Stanley, you heard
works.
Anything?
That's not one that I've heard, but there is a series of legends that you find all over the world, really, which is that any time a major construction project is taking place, if you want it to survive as a building, someone has to be interred in the foundation. Huh. And sometimes this is associated with legends about murders. Huh. Sometimes it's associated with accidents where a worker on, say, the Grand Coulee Dam loses his footing, falls into the wet cement, and is swallowed up for eternity. But it's amazing how often you've heard stories like these. I was in Hungary last year for a semester and collected a number of legends there which dealt with exactly the same thing. In one particular case, the construction foreman, after a series of accidents that had disabled workmen, the construction foreman said, all right, I know we have to put a woman, it had to be a woman in this particular version, we had to put a woman into the foundation of this building. So the next woman who shows up, we will kill and put into the foundation. Who is it who appears over the horizon? Of course, it's his wife. Wow. And they go through with it. And that legend has now been around in Hungary for about 150 years. But virtually every large building in the country has this legend associated with it, not to mention dams, highways, etc.
Yeah. You hear that in building of the dams. They're full of bodies that fell in during the process. Is that part of a legend or is there some kernel of truth to that?
I heard that there were six workers in the concrete at Boulder or Hoover Dam. And I've also been told that, no, that's
part of the legend.
Folklore.
Wow. But I think the important thing here is not the exact number of bodies that are in the foundation, but what we're doing when we build dams, skyscrapers, et cetera, is we're challenging the natural laws of the universe. We're challenging gravity. Hmm. We may be challenging God's will through our own hubris. It's like a Greek tragedy, really. And a sacrifice has got to be made. A price has got to be paid if we are to succeed in this. And I think that that's the core belief system that's at work there.
The story of the Tower of Babel, which is a classic.
Yeah.
But there's another construction story that I was told, I believe, in Sunday school, that Brigham Young directed that there be this big shaft left in the Salt Lake Temple. And the builders looked at the plans and they go, well, we don't need that. So they didn't put it in. And when Young said they saw they hadn't built it, he ordered them to go back and put in that shaft. And it was just the shaft they used for the elevators. I also believe that's not a true story.
Yeah, no, I've heard that.
And partly the story was told to show the prophetic insight because there weren't elevators. Well, the first elevator, Otis patented it, I think, in 1851 or so.
Yeah. Andrea had a question or at least a comment about the Bear Lake Monster. She called earlier, but also Michael, same kind of comment, hearing that the Bear Lake Monster and the Loch Ness Monster were the same, that the two waters were somehow connected underground. Why? Michael says, because these two areas on either side of the world are the only place Cisco fish can be found. So there's this series of tunnels under which. Have you heard that?
I didn't know about the Cisco.
Yeah, neither did I. Michael, thanks very much. Will Bagley is with us along with David Stanley. I'm going to take another break. Back in a moment. This is Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio.
You say that there ain't no monster that lives underneath Bear Lake. You think I'm an urban legend, but that is a big mistake. You say that hard to swallow. I think you believe in me. Under the lake.
Under Bear Lake.
Under Bear Lake.
Swimmers are sweet, and when they've been eaten, raspberry shakes. This is a place for folk cuisine, based in SPF 15. Bear Lake Osaurus, your lovely Taurus, under Bear Lake. Like Hefner, I got the grotto, though my plumbing's not so great. But come north to play the lotto, you might be my next playmate. Though bite marks could cause a bit of concerns from the HMO, you owe me for getting rid of the in-laws from Idaho.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we are talking about legends, Utah legends and other legends. Folklorist David Stanley is with us, along with the historian Will Bagley. Let's go back to the phones. Josh is with us in Salt Lake. Josh, hi.
Hi. From what I understand, there's a series of tunnels that go from the Salt Lake Temple underneath the ground to some apartment buildings and to the Capitol building, which is actually a fair distance away. I was wondering how much of that is true. Are there other tunnels? Are those tunnels even, do they even exist?
Well, this is a great question. David Stanley, what do you know about the tunnels legend? Because, in fact, we got an email from Gerald who writes, this is not a question. Let's see. He said, the tunnels under Main Street at least were real when I saw them a number of years ago. So people have seen some tunnel under the city, the question of whether or not they reach into mysterious places. What do you know about that legend?
Well, tunnel legends are just as universal as skeletons in the foundation legends are. Many times there are indeed tunnels, and they in the old days there was often a central steam heating plant, and tunnels were needed to provide a passageway for water lines, electrical lines, and so on. There's a common sense explanation for that. Years ago, when I was doing research at the time of the renovation of the city and county building, I discovered that there were rumors of tunnels that connected the city and county building with the court buildings that used to be where the Salt Lake City Library is now. And what's interesting is the tunnels may be there, but the legends that are attached to them always have to do with illegal or surreptitious or immoral activity. In fact, during the renovation of the city and county building, the workers opened up a door that they hadn't known was there. And indeed, there was a tunnel that led underneath 2nd East to the court's building and was used to move, I suppose, prisoners and people like that back and forth so they didn't have to be out in public. But what they found there were cases and cases of rations left over from the Cold War of the 1950s when the tunnel was designated as the place to go if the atomic bomb should go off.
The fallout shelter. What do you know of the tunnel legend, Will Bagley?
Well, some of them there is a foundation, of course.
Yeah, but is there a tunnel to the Capitol? That seems improbable.
I would think that's very improbable.
Yeah.
And there is a network of tunnels through the LDS buildings. But many Utah older homes had tunnels so that polygamists could escape from federal investigators. And during Prohibition, there was a similar tactic used to provide an escape for a bootlegger. There's a great story that Wilson McCarthy's family tells that when he went back to serve on the Reconstruction Finance Corporation, which Hoover set up to lend billions of dollars to banks to solve the liquidity crisis of 1932.
Sounds familiar.
Sounds familiar. Didn't work. And they rented a house out in Maryland that had a tunnel that the bootlegger who'd owned the building before had used. Wilson's family also had a tunnel associated with their home in American Fork so that his father could escape the polygamous prosecutions. But the great tie-in to this one is after Wilson moved his family back west after about a year, a young congressman named Richard M. Nixon bought the house and the tunnel.
You should have kept them. Well, these tunnel legends, of course, go back to the days of the Underground Railroad as well. And it got its name for a reason. And certainly there are emergency escape routes that are either purpose-built or that are used, just as there are tornado shelters and fallout shelters and the rest of that. But what I find interesting is that the widespread assumption that people are somehow up to no good or up to secret activity. And the tunnels are examples of that, yeah. I think.
But there are real tunnels. I believe there's stories that Rock Springs, Chinatown was in tunnels. But if you go to Pendleton, Oregon, their old Chinatown really is underneath the streets.
Yeah, yeah. I think Seattle, too, has an underground part of the old town. Josh, thanks. Steve is with us in Camas. Steve, sorry if they're late. Hi.
Hey, how you doing?
Good.
I moved to Utah quite a few years ago, back in the historic days of, like, the 70s, you know, a long time ago. And it's amazing what people then thought of inhabitants of Utah at that time. I mean, as far as I knew, they said they all looked like Will. You know, they had beards and horns and tails.
And horns.
And nine wives.
When
and
I lived
got
in
here, the... and of course I've lived here for quite a while. And the most amazing part about that legend was I found that it's true.
the story of Mormons having tails. You compiled a book that explained. I can't remember the name of the fellow who the folklorist who. But where's the origin of this idea that Mormons have horns?
Well, I think it has to do with a traditional European gesture made with two fingers, which basically, if you use that gesture to another male, what you're saying is that your wife is unfaithful to you. You are a cuckold. You have the horns of a goat. Goats, of course, are associated with, should we say, a kind of random activity. And that's it. I believe that what happened was that the goat symbol and the gesture, along with the traditional notion that the devil has horns, were attached to Mormons both because of their religious beliefs, their missionary activity in Europe, and polygamy. That's my guess at any rate. But certainly it's very, very widespread.
I lived way back woods in the Smoky Mountains, and I was introduced to an old farmer who somehow learned that I was a Utah Mormon. And then he looks at me closely, and then he says, "Where are your horns?"
But there's another side to that as well, and there's a story that Bert Wilson collected of a pair of Mormon missionaries who were doing a mission, and they were tracting, and they knocked on the door of a house and were invited in, and they were sitting and talking about their faith. And the woman of the household looked at them and leaned over to one and reached out her hand, and she said, "But you don't have any horns." And he said, "Well, yes, I do. Just feel right up here." And she put out her hand and felt all over his head, and she said, "I don't feel anything." And he said, "Not even a little foolish."
Good story. Steve, thanks very much. Mm-hmm. Back to the phones. Jenny is with us in Salt Lake. Jenny, hi.
Oh, hi. I want to call and talk about Kay's Cross. I grew up in Davis County and spent my high school years visiting that place. And I just want to know what the lore is about that. I know that at some point there's also a lore about the guy with the salt pellets at the end of the street that would shoot you if you went across his yard to get through to the trail. And then you'd run down the trail and all of a sudden, I mean, there's this huge cross. And all I knew is supposedly somebody was buried in there, and it was cut out. And that was what was passed on through my high school.
It was passed on from in my childhood, too, the stories of Kay's Cross. And
right.
It's one of those things where people, Will and David, aren't exactly sure the legend of Kay's Cross. If you're up in Davis County, you may have your story of Kay's Cross. A lot of people have seen it.
Yes.
I can't say I have. Have you?
Of course.
Oh, you have. So, okay,
yes,
so it's no legend.
Times.
Yeah, you've seen it. You walked around Kay's Cross.
Yeah. At night, of course.
Of course, at night. I mean, so there must be this. There must be some. This has a motif that must be somewhat familiar, where there's a cross or some sort of marker or something that takes on a life of its own.
Marker.
Yeah.
An out of place.
We tend to invent legends, or we tend to pass on legends to explain the unexplainable. And when we find something remarkable, whether it's a cross or whether it's a particularly prominent mausoleum in the Salt Lake City Cemetery, or whether it's a park-like oasis on 13th East called Allen Park, otherwise known as Hobbitville, local people will very often invest such a place with
my kids have heard of the hobbits at Hobbitville. I have to say, it's a legend that persists.
It certainly does. Yep. And
every group of these young people have at least one person in them, or it wasn't far removed of someone who actually did see or was chased by a little person in Hobbitville, which that must be one of the characteristics too, right?
Yep. And I mean, it's really amazing. Teenagers are especially fond of these. Why is that? Well, they're at a point in time when they're starting to go out on their own. They're starting to experiment with adulthood. They're starting to drive.
Yeah.
They're starting to stay out at night when things are dark and spooky. And they're also starting to form social relationships with the opposite sex and with their own as well. And so teenagers will have what we call legend quests, where they go out to a haunted house or to a cemetery or to a spooky place to prove or disprove whether the legend is true or not. And they do this, of course, often by testing it, by circling around Emo's grave three times, chanting, by staring into a particular mirror to see if a face appears.
Bloody Mary or whatever, yeah.
Right. Bloody Mary is a good one.
Yeah.
And I think what's happening here, of course, is that they're really testing their own courage as well as trying to prove something to their peers. But if there is a characteristic kind of folklore that we think of attached to teenagers, certainly the legend quest and the supernatural legend in a particular local place is a big part of that.
And the alien symbology of the cross, Mormons haven't adopted the cross as a symbol of their faith.
So in Davis County, it would make sense that that would seem odd for some.
Yes. Yeah. And I remember going to East Mill Creek Elementary School. One of my classmates, I assume, was Catholic or Protestant, and she came one day with a cross, and I was just fascinated by it because you just didn't see public displays of crosses in Utah.
Jenny, thanks very much. Here's an email from Greg who writes, there's a Paiute legend in Cedar City, a legend of two Paiute lovers that were turned to stone in Cedar Canyon. About 5 miles up Cedar Canyon, Greg writes, just north of Highway 14, there are at least, or were anyway until a few years ago, two sandstone pillars that were the petrified lovers, as the story goes. This seems a typical one, and it always seems there's an Indian maiden jumping off some great rock formation too. David Stanley?
Yeah, it's Romeo and Juliet in Buckskin.
Yeah.
Mark Twain satirized the popularity of these Indian legends in the great book that he wrote, Life on the Mississippi. And he talked about the idea that every bluff, every cliff, every town along the Mississippi River had its Indian lover suicide story. And a lot of this, I think, has a kind of a resemblance to Pocahontas, which is also an absolutely phony legend that's been, shall we say, romanticized by the Disney people. The important thing is that that whites have seen a natural feature and have romanticized the Indian into a doomed figure, doomed by civilization, by progress, by the progress of the frontier, those things, and. As a result, what we always have is the Indian couple in love with each other, but they are separated by distance and by typically the opposition of their families, which betrays an absolute ignorance of the way most Native American groups carried out courtship and marriage.
Yeah.
But it's a way of it's a way really of whites dealing with their own guilt about what they were doing to Indian civilizations.
Let me ask you, we've got about a minute left. Why are there so many folklorists in Utah? This is pretty rich ground, I guess.
Run down the list of names. It's fantastic.
I don't think we have time for all the names, but we've been bragging since 1985 that Utah has more folklorists per capita than any other state. And if somebody wants to go out and count, I think that would be great. But we had great folk song collectors, Lester Hubbard and Thomas Cheney and Olive Burt. We had great collectors of three Nephite legends like Austin and Alta Fife and Wayland Hand and Hector Lee. And we've had great folklorists at Utah State, Barry Tolkien, Jan Brunvand, the king of the urban legend at the University of Utah,
and we've
Burt Wilson.
We've got the best folklore. Wallace Stegner demonstrated that in Mormon Country, which is a fantastic collection.
Will Bagley, David Stanley, gentlemen, thanks very much. Radio West is a production of KUER News. For links to resources mentioned on today's program or to continue the conversation on our online discussion board, go to our website at KUER.org. Radio West is directed by Mike Anderson, produced by Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.
In Salt Lake City, I hold down this bar stool hoping you come back again. Bartender who watered down this